We've often heard the expression that those who don't learn from history are bound to repeat its mistakes. Or I like what I heard someone else say, or actually read someone else say. They said, one thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. Honestly, though, I'm not sure exactly what people expect. We're people. We have a hard time keeping a great perspective on things, and while we do learn from hard experience, usually in our own personal lives, it's difficult for us to grasp a bigger picture as in the history of our own people or the history of peoples in other times and places and see what the results of that might be and therefore change our own way of life and it makes some kind of difference. The scripture we read this morning is Isaiah chapter 44. And we want to see if we can learn something from history. It's a very interesting time, a very tragic time in some ways in the history of God's people, the ancient Israelites. We know somewhat about the history of King Saul and of King David and King Solomon. But probably after that, for most of us, it gets kind of fuzzy. After Solomon dies, his son becomes king and the kingdom divides because his son is not a good king, does not make good decisions. He does not win people over to himself. He alienates them. And so the kingdom divides into a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom called Judah. And that northern kingdom, those men who ruled over it as its kings, quickly decided that if they allowed their people in the north to come down to the south to continue to worship Jehovah God at Jerusalem, that pretty soon they would want to be reunited as one nation again, and they would be out of a job. And so from the very beginning, the nation of Israel in the north introduced the worship of idols. At first, it was just an idol of a golden calf. And they would say, well, this golden calf isn't an idol. It only represents the God who brought us out of Egypt. Just like our ancestor Aaron and Miriam and others of our ancestors worshiped the golden calf in the wilderness. So we're just putting up a golden calf here so people can worship it and be reminded of the God who brought us out of Egypt. Well, that was the excuse for putting it up. But the reality was that very quickly, within a generation, the people in the northern kingdom were worshiping practically any and every idol and every kind of false god that existed in their part of the world. And this all with a blessing and even the promotion of the government. Well, in the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, where Jerusalem was located and the temple to the worship of the true God Jehovah was located, those people tried to stay faithful to the worship of God. But gradually, the kings who served over them became less devoted and dedicated to the worship of the true God and became more and more dedicated to either those things that aligned them with certain other kingdoms in the world of their day. In other words, if Assyria was exerting a tremendous influence in that part of the world, then some of the kings, even of Judah, said, well, we need to show our alliance with Assyria. And one way to do that is by letting their gods be worshipped here, so people from Assyria would feel comfortable here. But once you start introducing that, there was no turning back. And so we hit on this tragic time in the history of the Jewish people, starting in about 740 B.C., in which we started having kings, even in the southern kingdom, who are worshipping idols. And while we don't have the time and inclination to tell all about the history of that time, as it's recorded in the books of Kings and Chronicles, and that are reflected in the writings and speaking of some of the great prophets of the Old Testament, we can speak of some of those things that directly reflect on what Isaiah is trying to do in his book. In 740 B.C., roughly, we had a king by the name of Uzziah. Now, he's already been king for a while in Judah. Was a good king, but he became self-important. And he thought he was such a good worshiper of God that he didn't have to obey God's law. And so he decided one day that instead of having the high priest, who had to be from the tribe of Levi, to officiate at the offerings to God at the altar in front of the temple, that he would take it upon himself to serve as a high priest and make those offerings. God struck him with leprosy. Leprosy physically made him unclean, as well as made him unable to go into the parts of the temple where before, as a man of Israel, he would have been allowed to go. The leprosy really represented God's way of saying, you were already unclean as far as you trying to be a high priest. Now you truly are unclean. The man lived the rest of his life as a leper. His son, Jotham, began to serve as a co-regent along with him because his father was no longer able to do many of the things as king that he would have done otherwise because of his leprosy. And so Jotham, starting in about 740 BC, becomes king. Jotham was a godly king. Overall, he was not, you know, the records don't say a great deal about him to us, except that he did honor and serve God, and he recognized that the world around them was changing. They were threatened by Egypt, they were threatened by Assyria, they were even threatened by the northern kingdom of Israel. Some of the other nations around them, Moab and Ammon and Edom, were rattling their swords and making threats against them. So he started to build up the fortifications of his kingdom. And after his father Uzziah died, then he took his son Ahaz and made him his co-regent. So you start having this practice that went on for a while where you would have both the father and the son sort of serving as king together. Well, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, served under his father as his co-regent until Jotham passed away, was greatly honored by the Jewish people at his death. But as soon as his father died, Ahaz showed his true colors. He almost immediately stopped worshiping God and stopped giving any deference or preference to the worship of Jehovah at the temple. Ahaz had been attacked by Israel, the northern kingdom, and he didn't have the army and the resources to fight off that attack. So he had asked Assyria, this great nation way up to the north and east of them, to step in and be his ally against Israel. Well, Assyria says, why would we want to do that? He said, well, let me reward you for being my ally. He emptied the government's treasury. He went into the temple and emptied the treasury of the temple and took most of the items made out of gold and silver out of the temple, collected all those things up, put them on pack wagons and pack horses, and shipped them off to Assyria to pay Assyria to be his ally against Israel. Well, this was really a direct violation of what God had commanded all the way back in the days of Moses and several times since that about making unholy alliances with the nations around them. And inviting Assyria into Judah is just like the old proverb about the camel putting his nose under the edge of the tent. You're never going to get him out of the tent after that. That's what happened. Assyria came in and did for pay what they really would have done for nothing, because they really wanted to control this part of their world. So they did help Judah drive away Israel and actually crushed Israel's army and put them in a position where they eventually, within just a few years, would actually be destroyed by Assyria and carried away into captivity. This is when the 10 northern tribes were carried away into captivity in Assyria, never to return. This was all in part because Ahaz participated in bringing Assyria into this part of the world. And Ahaz was so anxious to please the Assyrians and keep them on his side that when he went up to Damascus and met with the commanders of Assyria, he saw a great altar up there they had built to worship their god with, and he was so enthralled with it, he had his architects or his builders look at that altar, and when he came back to Jerusalem, he had an altar built just like it, right in front of the temple. This was not an altar to the Most High God. This was an altar to an idol. He had the temple closed, shuttered, locked. He forbade people to come there to worship Jehovah. They could only come up onto the temple grounds if they were there to worship the idol and make sacrifices on that altar. Not only that, he surrounded the city with other altars and high places, as they were called, to the worship of other deities. of the nations around them. He introduced abominations into God's place of worship. His son was named Hezekiah. And Hezekiah again served with his father Ahaz as co-king for about 15 years, 14 or 15 years. But once his father died, Ahaz, this ungodly king, Hezekiah immediately tried to reverse what his father had done. He reopened the temple. He had it refurbished. He had a great celebration as they observed Passover. He had the high places torn down around the city. He had that altar removed completely and crushed, the stones even crushed that it was built out of. He was very diligent to try to return people to the worship of God. Some of the people had even started to worship the old bronze serpent that Moses had raised up in the wilderness all those hundreds of years before. They had worshipped it like an idol. Hezekiah even took it and destroyed it, even though it was a precious historical object. He had it destroyed because people were now worshipping it like it was an idol, a serpent god. He declared independence from Assyria. That was a very dangerous thing to do because by that time Assyria had already come down and conquered the northern nation and they were busy conquering all the nations around him. And yet he said, God being on my side, we will not have an alliance with Assyria. And King Sennacherib, king of the Assyrians, says, there has been no God who has been able to stand against me and my army, and your God will not be able to do so either. And he attacked Judah, invaded it, in the records that it still exists from the time of King Sennacherib. On his records, he said he destroyed 46 fortified cities in Judah and took more than 200,000 people as slaves. He marched up to Jerusalem itself and he surrounded it. And he said in his own record that I had Hezekiah closed up in Jerusalem like a bird closed up in a cage. But then the next line in his record says, and then I packed up and went home. What he doesn't mention is what's found in the Bible. And that is that one day Sennacherib's commander stands out in front of the wall of Jerusalem and says, surrender or we will destroy you. Your God cannot protect you from me. And that night the angel of death passed through the camp of the Assyrian army and 185,000 soldiers died in one night. The next morning, Sennacherib woke up and discovered he didn't have enough of an army left to make a campaign. And so with what he had left, they packed up and went home. Hezekiah was a good king. He tried to reverse the evil effects of his father. He tried to do what God wanted him to do. And although he was a man and did some things that were not right, God even extended his life for 15 years so he could continue to serve as king. But when he died, his son Manasseh became king. And Manasseh served as probably the longest or one of the longest of all the kings of Judah, 55 years. But what a wicked king he was. How such a good king like Hezekiah could have such an evil son. Manasseh seemed to take delight in introducing all sorts of worship of false gods into Israel. It says in the New Unger's Bible Dictionary, that ascending to the throne at the early age of 12, he yielded to the influence of the idolatrous and became in time a determined and even fanatical idolater. This is the king. As he grew up, he took delight in introducing into his kingdom the superstitions of every heathen country. The high places were restored, the groves replanted. These were the things his father had destroyed. The altars of Baal and Asherah rebuilt, and the sun, moon, and all the host of heaven were worshipped. The gods of Ammon, of Moab, and of Edom were zealously worshipped everywhere. Babylonian and Egyptian paganism was common. Incense and offerings rose on the roofs of the houses to the fabled deities of the heights. Wizards practiced their enchantments, and the valley of Hinnom was once more disgraced by the hideous statue of Molech, to whom parents offered up their children as burnt sacrifices. And in the very temple of the Lord stood an image of Asherah and white horses harnessed to a splendid chariot sacred to the sun that were placed in the entrance of the court. This apostasy did not go unrebuked by the prophets, whom the king endeavored to silence by the fiercest persecution recorded in all the annals of Israel. fuller particulars of this persecution are preserved by Josephus, who says that executions took place every day. And according to the tradition of the rabbis, Isaiah himself was sawn in two by order of Manasseh, and after his death, the prophetic voice was heard no more in Judah. When we read in Isaiah, this is what the Lord says, Israel's King and Redeemer, the Lord Almighty, I am the first and the last. Apart from me, there is no God. This is what Isaiah was preaching to a population who was entranced by this leadership of King Manasseh, who was, as almost every time you turned around, some other idol had been erected on the grounds of the temple where once God himself was worshipped. There was this kind of religious pluralism that said anything goes and everything goes except the worship of God. And Isaiah spoke out strongly again. He was a prophet for 60 years. He started in the days of King Uzziah, the man struck by leprosy, and it served in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, and Manasseh. But it was in the days of Manasseh, as a very old man, probably in his late 70s or early 80s, but still serving as a prophet of God, that he is hauled out in front of the people and is publicly executed because he keeps telling the king and the people that what they're doing is sin against God and he will punish them for it. But part of what God says through Isaiah here in Isaiah 44 is that all these other gods aren't real. Now, yeah, they're idols, their images are real, but there is no real deity behind them. There is no real God that they represent. And God challenges them. If their gods can do what he can do, let them do it. And that appears not only here in Isaiah, but in numerous passages in the book. So God says in Isaiah 44:7, as we keep reading our verse for this morning, who then is like me? Let him proclaim it. Let him declare and lay out before me what has happened since I established my ancient people. And let him declare what is yet to come. Yes, let him foretell what will come. God appeals to the fact of what he had done in the past in their history as evidence of his power and his reality. What has these other gods done for them? What's the god of the Assyrians, the god of the Moabites or the Ammonites or the Egyptians? The sun god, we read there in the dictionary how that Manasseh had even set up the chariot of the sun being pulled by white horses. These images put right there in the Temple Mount area. That represented the Egyptian gods, the god of the sun. Well, what had any of those gods ever done for God's people? More than that, which of those gods had foretold anything that's going to happen in the future and it had come to pass? God had already done that. And he's doing it even as he speaks through Isaiah. He's telling them that not only has the northern nation now been destroyed, but now you will be destroyed as well. Which of those other gods had been able to do that? He says in verse 8, do not tremble, do not be afraid. Did I not proclaim this and foretell it long ago? You're my witnesses. God says, you know this is true. You've turned to the worship of these other gods, but I'm the only God there is. He says, is there any God besides me? This is a rhetorical question. The answer is no. No, there is no other rock. I know not one. And so in Isaiah, we see this contrast between all the idols and other gods they worshipped and the one true God. They had abandoned him for these others, and yet God, speaking through Isaiah, says, what can these other gods do for you? What have they done for you? How can they even prove they exist? He said, they're this things made out of stone, things made out of wood, things made by the hands of men, coming out of the imaginations of men, and they are not realities at all. And basically he says that here's the credentials. Here's the credentials of who he is. He says back in Isaiah, over in Isaiah 51 in verse 2, did not I call Abraham and Sarah and make them the father of my people? He appeals to what happened way back there in that time. Calling Abraham, calling Sarah, blessing them, guiding them, giving them this land, blessing them with a son. Then in Isaiah 63, he says, "Did I not deliver you by the hand of Moses from the Egyptians? Did I not bring you out?" He points to that point in their history, and it was God who did that. They had won a victory over the gods of Egypt at that time, and now they're going back to worshiping those gods. And he appeals to the fact that his power in nature and in weather, sort of like when we were reading in Job just recently in our Bible class, when God finally spoke in Job, he pointed to all the things in nature, from the sun and the moon and the stars, to the animals, to geography, to geology, to the weather. And God says, "These are the things I do, and I've demonstrated my power in them. What about your gods? What can they do?" And then as he says here in our Isaiah 44 passage, he says, "Not only have I told you the past," God had revealed what had happened to the past to them, "but he says, I'll also tell you what's going to happen in the future. Is there any God besides me?" Of course, we've heard sermons and looked at lessons together before about how God predicted the future. A couple of them really stand out in my mind about Isaiah in particular, is that here Isaiah is going to die in around AD 680. That's approximately the time we think that he was executed. And yet before he died, not only did he predict that God would allow this nation of Judah to be destroyed, not by the Assyrians, by the way, that was the world power at this time, and that's who they were all afraid of, but Isaiah predicted, as God told him, that they were actually going to be destroyed by the Babylonians. When the Babylonians were hardly a blimp on the radar, historically at this point. And yet it will be about 70 years after Isaiah dies that suddenly the Babylonians win a great victory over the Assyrians, destroy Nineveh, put the remnant of the Ninevite army or the Assyrian army on the run, and will finally destroy the last of them in about 603 B.C. And suddenly Assyria is not only not a world power, they don't even exist anymore, and Babylon is the world power. It happened some 70 years after Isaiah had already died, and yet Isaiah had already told his people it would happen. You see, God predicting the future, something only God could do. You know, to be able to predict the future accurately implies a couple of things. Number one, either you somehow stand outside of history so you can see beyond your present time, and or you can control what happens. You have the power to make it happen. And both is true of God. But a second thing that Isaiah prophesied more than once is that God was going to one day raise up a man by the name of Cyrus, and he even mentioned him by name, who one day would see that Jerusalem and the temple was rebuilt. Now, Isaiah is talking to an audience who not only has very little interest in worshiping God, but they're living in a city, Jerusalem, that doesn't seem to be in danger of being destroyed. And even though they've closed the temple and aren't using it to worship God, there doesn't seem to be any danger of it being destroyed. And yet Isaiah has predicted both the city and the temple will be destroyed. And now suddenly he predicts that God is going to raise up a man one day by the name of Cyrus who will give the orders to have them both rebuilt. Now how could he know that? And yet that is what happened. Jerusalem and the temple was destroyed in 587 B.C., 93 years after Isaiah dies. The people are carried away into captivity in Babylon. And then suddenly in around 539 B.C., another nation rises up called the Medes, the empire of the Medes and the Persians. It's actually an alliance of two peoples, the Medes and the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire. They rise up and destroy Babylon, and they become the world power. And guess who their king was? His name was Cyrus. And once he had consolidated his victory over the Babylonians, he declared that not only that could the foreign peoples go home, so the Jews who wanted to could now leave Babylon and go back to their ancient homeland, to the ruins of Jerusalem and the temple. But he also declared that the treasuries of the Babylonians needed to be opened up and all the treasures of the ancient temple could be sent home with the Jews. And he even sent government money to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. How did Isaiah know that would happen? because he was the prophet of the one true God who knew the future, who was going, not only knew what would happen, but was going to make it happen. And he named the man by name, Cyrus, who would do it. But then maybe for us, the most impressive thing is that Isaiah, as he spoke for God, kept prophesying about a time in the far distant future, he didn't know how far, when God was going to raise up someone else. The time is coming when a child is going to be born, but he's going to be born of a virgin. Isaiah chapter 7. That he's going to be a light both to God's people and to the Gentiles. Isaiah chapter 9 and 10. That ultimately he would be called the Prince of Peace. Isaiah 9. And that he is going would be like the sacrificial lamb who would die for the sins of the people. Isaiah 53. Now how could he know those things? God said, "Is there any God besides me? Is there any other God who can tell both what happened in the past and what's going to happen in the future except me?" Isaiah spoke for the one true God. When any nation, past or present, begins to trust in its own wisdom and military strength, when it becomes government policy to actually remove God, the one true God, from the life and the minds of the people, when the government decides that it's more important to be politically correct and diverse and let all religions have equal say and actually persecute those who speak for the one true God, then is it possible we might be following the same path that the people in Isaiah's day was following? That's true not just of us. That would be true of Western Europe. One day, perhaps it'll be true of Africa, or India, or other places where the worship of God is rising and growing, even as it declines here. But who is God besides me? Jehovah says. There is none other. Men sometimes end up worshiping their military might, or their political power, or their economic prowess, or other things. But those aren't God. Those are all inventions of man. There's only one who knows the past and knows the future, and controls both. We serve him. We have to be like Isaiah and be a spokesman for him to keep telling people that there is one true God. Jehovah is his name.